Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the 66 to 87 podcast here on DK Pittsburgh Podcasting Network. I am your host and moderator, Tom Reed, joined as always by Taylor Haas and Dave Molinari, the TV analyst voice of the Penguins. Bob Erie, a two-time Stanley Cup champion, will be along with us a little bit later. He'll be our guest today. So a lot to get to. And hey, it's nice. We got a little bit of news. Teddy Bluger has re-upped with the club 2 years, $2.2 million a year. And a question that we will answer or have Taylor help answer in the next couple minutes is whether who's going to pay for that. Is that going to be the Penguins or the Seattle Kraken? But another thing that is just up on our site, we're recording here early Thursday afternoon. Our Dave Molinari spoke with Ron Hextall and had some interesting things to say. Dave, kind of give the readers who have not had at least had a chance to read your story yet, kind of where Hextall is with this team, the makeup of the team, maybe some thoughts on Tristan Jarry, and possibly what could fans look for in maybe some contract talks with Chris Letang in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I mean, the bottom line of it was that Hextall said that as things stand now, he doesn't anticipate making any profound changes to the makeup of this team going into next season. Specifically on Tristan Jarry, he gave him what I think you'd have to consider a very strong vote of confidence, and seemed to make it pretty clear that the Penguins plan to proceed with him as their go-to goalie. And as for Letang and Malkin, both of whom are going into the final year of their contracts, he said that the Penguins have been doing some research to kind of prepare for negotiations with those two, but that talks probably won't begin until sometime after the Penguins at least get through the early stages of free agency, in August.
Yeah. Taylor, I think we discussed in the past here when we discovered the severity of Malkin's knee injury and the time that he would miss, that his contract probably, if whatever re-up they're going to do with him, probably will be later in the year. Just probably both parties would rather see them decide where his value is and how he's playing before they ink any kind of deal. But with Letang, would you be surprised if a deal isn't done sometime before the start of the regular season? This feels like something that could be announced on like October 3rd before the season starts, or am I overstepping it there?
I don't know. I think with him, part of that is, you know, he kind of has to prove himself to just like for what kind of deal he's going to get. If he's going to take any sort of a pay cut or what kind of, like, we don't know what he wants. If he wants like a couple of years, like term, you know, we'd probably have to wait till later in the season. But I don't think there's any real rush to get it done. But yeah, I think him and you probably expect him to get him an extension before Malkin, but I think both of them, you're probably looking at the second half of the season would make sense.
Dave, I don't want to give away too much of our interview with Bob Erie, but he did had a very interesting, maybe one of those things where the fans say, yeah, but to hear Bob Erie say it, that among that the big three of this team, there's going to probably have to be some pay cuts. With a guy like Letang, assuming he does sign, do you see it being maybe drastic as far as the number or perhaps the term. I would think the term would not be that long.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how you make a long-term commitment to guys in their mid-30s. And I think he and Malkin both are going to have to take pay cuts. I mean, it's, you know, you pay players for what you expect them to do, you know, during the term of the contract, not for, you know, contracts aren't supposed to be lifetime achievement awards. You know, you aren't paying guys for what they did 2 or 3 years earlier. And, you know, neither of those guys is at the peak of his game anymore. So, you know, if they want to remain in Pittsburgh, and there's certainly every indication that they do, I think they will both be doing it at reduced salaries in coming seasons.
Dave, I'll stick with you for 1 second. Do you see? Again, we'll stick with Letang again, because with the injury of Malkin, there's so much uncertainty there. Do you see a contract getting done at least early in the season or before the start of the season with Letang? And if it lingers, does that say anything as we creep into the season that the two sides couldn't come to a deal? Because I think with Chris Letang, we pretty much know what kind of player he is, whether you love him or you think he is on the decline. I don't think there's a lot of secrets there.
Well, I mean, it depends on what kind of player Chris Letang thinks he is. You know, if he still thinks he's Chris Letang at his peak and, you know, playing at his best 82 games a year, then he's probably going to be looking for more money than the Penguins should be planning to give him. You know, I think both sides would like to reach a deal. There's not a great urgency. It's not as if, you know, he's on the cusp of free agency here. But, I mean, it really does depend on how realistic the parties are in the negotiations. If they're both willing to be flexible and to try to find a middle ground, I don't think it will be too terribly difficult for them to reach an agreement, even if it doesn't happen, you know, in 2 days or anything like that.
Taylor, as far as Hextall's comments about Tristan Jarry, he doesn't seem to have moved too far from what he said right at the end of the season. There's still a belief in him. Do you believe that that's what Hextall thinks, or is that really kind of what he's saying right now to the public and kind of a boost of confidence? Or do you think Hextall really believes this is a kid that definitely deserves a second chance and is going to get it, assuming they make the playoffs again next spring?
I think it would be hard to say what Hextall's really thinking, just because he hasn't been in the organization that long, so we're not really sure how he operates. He tends to keep things, you know, closer to himself, his thoughts closer. But I would tend to believe that he believes what he's saying about Tristan Jarry, because, I mean, we've talked about it before. Jarry is young. There's such a, you know, small sample size, and he has, you know, he has been really good in the regular season. So I don't know if, you know, you look at this past playoffs and you just write him off completely. I think you give him another shot. So I think, you know, in this case, maybe Hextall is, you know, actually saying what he believes, and he is confident that Tristan Jarry can rebound. But it's hard to say just because we don't know Hextall that well yet.
Dave, what do you think the level of the franchise's confidence is in Tristan Jarry coming into a new season?
Well, I mean, I'm willing to take Hextall at his word until he proves to us that we shouldn't take him at his word. You know, he's been reasonably forthcoming and candid, you know, to this point. And so, you know, until we catch him, you know, if not flat out lying, then, you know, being deceitful, you know, I will continue to give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that what he says about Jarry is an accurate reflection of his feelings. He certainly could have couched his support for Jarry more than he did.
Yeah,
he was pretty straightforward and you know, verging on emphatic about it. So, no, I will take him at his word.
It is such an interesting it is such an interesting time for these Penguins. And I agree. I agree with both of you guys. But it's an interesting time in that if this team were just kind of on the come, so to speak, just made the playoffs last year, got bounced, I think there'd be a lot more like, okay, Tristan Jarry, you know, he can grow into it. Well, we've seen other goaltenders have bad starts. I think what complicates it is the fact that, again, whether the window's open or it's rapidly closing or it's closed, or is rapidly closing, you can't afford another performance from Tristan Jarry, which he got last year. So that kind of really ramps up the urgency for him and for the team to kind of get their act together and get beyond the first round for the first time in 4 years. And obviously, first you have to make the playoffs, and we'll see where that goes. Another person we'll see where he goes is Teddy Bluger, as we led the show with. Teddy Bluger, new two-year, $2.2 million per season. I'm right there, 2.2, Taylor?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, but now the question becomes, is it going to be here, or is Seattle going to jump in? And I know you guys have heard us talk about this a lot, but it's a very interesting point. And then Taylor, you know, she wrote today in her drive column about, you know, does it come down to Bluger or McCann? For those who haven't had a chance to read it, lay out your piece for us, Taylor.
It's about the Bluger. Because of the Bluger extension, I guess you could look at it two ways. Like, so the way I led with it is I think this means that they're likely to protect him. That might not be the case because it is a very reasonable deal. So I led with, you know, do sign him to this deal because that just makes him more appealing to Seattle, 2.2 per year. That's pretty reasonable for what he is. I guess you could look at it the other way and say this makes him – maybe they could leave him exposed and, you know, they want them to take him instead of, you know, McCann or Tanev or one of those guys. But I was working under the assumption that this means they're going to protect him. Along with, you know, kind of the ones I think are given, Crosby, Malkin, Gensel, Rust, Kapanen, so and Bluger. So then you can protect seven forwards. So then that last spot, it's between Tanev and McCann. Who would you protect? And I mean, there you could make the case for either of them. They both bring very different things. I would have to protect McCann. If it does come down to those two, I would protect McCann. I mean, he led the team in power play goals last season. He can play in the top power play unit and in the top six if needed. And he's 4 years younger and $560,000 cheaper than Tanev. He's just the better asset. And as young as he is, I think he has the potential to grow into a bigger role. So if the Bluger extension does mean they're going to protect him, I think that means that, you know, McCann is that last spot, and you might leave Tanev exposed.
Hall of Famer, jump in there. You've Bluger, Tanev, McCann, those three seems to be the ones that people have the most, I don't want to say trouble with, but certainly debatable, as Taylor laid out. Where do you go there?
Well, I mean, I directly asked Hextall if signing Bluger has an impact on how the Penguins would handle him in the expansion draft, and he very deftly dodged it by saying no, it would not change their stance on him, but he did not say what that stance is. My guess is that they will replace him. I can't imagine that Hextall would have been looking to do Ron Francis's work for him by negotiating a contract for Teddy Bluger so that he could play in Seattle. So I'm guessing that he will be on the protected list. And if it comes down to a call between Tanev and McCann, I go with Tanev. I have very grave doubts about how effective he will be when he's at the end of the 4 years he has remaining on his contract, just because of the wear and tear that his style has. But I think he's one of the forces that drives this team, that he provides an energy that it desperately needs. So I think that if they were to lose him to the Kraken, it would be a significant setback that goes beyond that of, you know, losing a typical fourth line winger.
And it in some ways, it goes against everything that they have kind of been saying, right, since they've gotten here, Burke and Hextall, that they want to be harder to play against. They use, I think, size is the word that gets thrown out a lot. But let's be honest, he plays a lot bigger than whatever he is. I'm not even sure his measurements are accurate that they post. I don't know. I think Tanev. I know what you're saying, Dave. But I could still see Bluger. I don't know. That's an interesting. I would not want to lose Brandon Tanev. But Taylor, you raised the point about the power play goals, and that's important. I guess it does go down to the fact that they're going to lose a good player.
I mentioned it in the story too, that, you know, contracts really matter here. McCann, I mean, he's young. He has 1 year left on his deal. He makes $2.94 million, and he's an RFA at the end. That's a very, like, appealing contract to Seattle. And then you look back at the Vegas draft, and Vegas was willing to take on maybe players that you consider overpaid as long as they didn't have a lot of term left. So someone like Matheson, they probably wouldn't take, because they have a lot of he has like, you know, a couple of years left. Tanev, you know, some could argue that he is overpaid at $3.5 million. But he has 4 years left on that. So that might be a deterrent for Seattle, because if he isn't a fit there, you're stuck with that cap hit for another 4 years. Whereas someone like, you know, Zucker, his $5.5 million cap hit is high, but he only has 2 years left. So I mentioned it in the story that maybe if, you know, you protect McCann, leave Tanev exposed, his contract could be more of a deterrent than Zucker's is. So maybe that could lead them more in the direction of Jason Zucker. I mean, we've talked about the merits of Seattle taking Zucker, that, you know, he has had, you know, what, a 33-goal season before. He hasn't been a fit in Pittsburgh. That doesn't mean he wouldn't be a fit there. So, you know, he might be worth them taking a gamble on. So that was part of my reasoning, too, of protecting McCann over Tanev, that, you know, maybe that would entice them to take Zucker more, just because of the way the contracts work out.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is shaping up to be a really intriguing decision they have. And as Dave always mentions, if there's another Brandon Tanev out there, and there are guys that certainly play with that kind of grit, and they take him off that team, then they probably won't need two Brandon Tanevs getting started. So it's very interesting. It's good, okay. What's the day? What day is this? As far as when do they have to? Cards on the table.
Saturday is when lists are due. So if you're listening, this is good. Our podcast is going up Friday. So yeah, lists are due Saturday at 5 p.m.
Damn it. Listen to the podcast beforehand.
And I have to add, Freddie Gaudreau can play PK. So
here we go. Here we go.
They have four, you know, if they re-sign him, they re-sign Aston Reese. I mean, they have, you know, forwards that can play the PK.
I haven't looked on the website. Are you listed now as Freddie Gaudreau's agent? I'm not looking at an updated list here. You're certainly the merchandising person. You're gonna make a mint on Freddie Hockey.
Well,
he's running here in Pittsburgh.
His agent is Pat Brisson, and as we mentioned before, Pat Brisson, he does take on all the big stars. You know, Sidney Crosby, Freddie Gaudreau. So he has a good setup there.
You also have some Pierre shirts out here pretty soon. You'll be shipping up to Ottawa.
Regis McGuire is calling us up here, so he seems French Canadian.
This has been a wonderful first segment today. We've actually had news to talk about, some debate. All right, let's move on to one of the things that we are doing in the off season, as listeners to the 60-87 podcast know, is we've kind of taken it each day, a day on the podcast, and play, given our kind of player evaluation for that. That day. And today is Kasperi Kapanen, who's back with the organization this year. Had a bit of a slow start, but I thought had a pretty, you know, pretty decent season. But we'll let our experts weigh in. 40 games, 11 goals, 19 assists, plus 15. Didn't do much on the power play. One power play goal. Good speed. The kind of type of player that you would think would endear himself to the Mike Sullivan system. Dave, let's start with you. Your overview on his first season back with the club.
I mean, he had a decent season. He certainly is capable of more. I think it's only reasonable that the coaching staff and front office would expect him to contribute more, you know, next season. He, you know, it was difficult for him. He not only was coming to a new team, but, you know, his arrival into the country was delayed because of COVID issues. And, you know, so, you know, there were some mitigating circumstances for him, certainly. You know, his speed is a great asset. He has a nice shot. I don't see any reason that he can't be a 30-goal guy at this level. And, you know, he seemed to have a pretty good chemistry with Malkin. Now, obviously, you know, Malkin's status, especially early in the season, is up in the air. But I think those two could form a pretty effective partnership.
Taylor, what say you?
Yeah, I mean, so it kind of reminds me of, do you remember when Alex Galchenyuk came to the team? He told a story about, you know, how he showed up and he had all of his sticks. And Malkin was next to him. Malkin tried out his sticks, and Malkin really liked him. Malkin's like, these are mine now. And he took some of Galchenyuk's sticks to use for himself. So, when you know, the way this relates to Kapanen is, like, Kapanen was kind of brought in and expected to be, you know, Crosby's winger, but then he fit really good with Malkin, and it's like, Malkin's like, this is mine now. And, I mean, they really, their chemistry, the way it builds up over the season, the passes they were making, they looked really good. Now, again, Malkin, like Dave said, probably not going to be ready to start the season, but I mean, the offense he was putting up, he's, you know, he said, you know, maybe he could be a 30 goal guy at this level. His 11 goals in 40 games, that's on pace for in a normal 82 game season, that's 23 goals. That's a lot. I mean, this was by far his most, you know, successful off season offense wise. His past, you know, full NHL seasons, he was kind of at half a point per game. This season it was 0.75 points per game. I mean, that's a pretty significant jump. And he's still young. He could still keep, I mean, he's the youngest forward on the team. The guys who are regulars in the lineup, he could still keep improving. So, if he can't play with Malkin, to start, I'd be excited for him next season to see what kind of steps he takes.
Well, in fairness, I mean, who can break into the dynastic lineup that is the Toronto Maple Leafs? I think they've won like four or five cups now. So he may find it easier here in Pittsburgh. We will move on. Roundtable coming up. The Stanley Cup just took a beating this past week. We'll ask Taylor.
Go ahead, Taylor.
Just jump in there.
With the cup. So we recorded that second segment already. Since then, Pat Maroon, I don't know if you guys saw, he did say how the cup got dented. So if you saw Tampa, their cup celebration got cut short because of the rain. It started pouring. And Pat, he was on like ESPN radio or something, and he said he was carrying a cup and he was kind of running with it, and he fell. And when he got, like, he said he hurt his own back and he dropped the cup. So it doesn't sound like they're screwing around, but he ran with the cup and dropped it. So
I think Pat Maroon once said about his own skill when he came into the league, and I don't know if it was said by Maroon or about Maroon, he said, I could stick handle in a phone booth if I could fit in it. What a career, though, he's had. This is a guy that was about to be waived by the St. Louis Blues, and other injuries kept that from happening, and since then he's won three consecutive cups. Great guy, good player. All right, we're going to move on. We'll talk about the cup. We got Bob Erie coming. Don't leave us, and make sure you're listening to this before Saturday. We'll be back on the 66-87 podcast.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to the 66 to 87 podcast here on the DK Sports Podcasting Network. It's our favorite time to go roundtable and kind of have some discussions about some things around the league, around the Penguins, and we're finally starting to get closer to some real action in the NHL. And I wanted to point out something today that last couple of days that over at The Athletic, Dom Lecision, who does a nice job over there, kind of broke down the top 50 free agents that will be available. Now, I want to discuss this a little bit about some of the people. Obviously, the Penguins are not going to be in the market for a Dougie Hamilton or Gabriel Landeskog or anyone like that. But there's certainly some intriguing options near the bottom of the list or the bottom half of the list. Now, all this said, we have to say that we don't know who the Penguins are going to lose yet or any of these teams are going to lose yet in the expansion draft. And in some cases, I can see the name Casey Cizikas come up that's on this list. Whether the Islanders would try to re-sign him, you'd think they would. But we're just going to go with the list today, and because there are some interesting names on there, and we'll start right there. Let's start with Cizikas. If Taylor, if we go by the thought of that the Penguins may lose a guy like Teddy Bluger, we talked about this the other day. He certainly would be somebody I would think that Ron Francis would look at. All of a sudden, you have a hole there in what is a very good line, and again, we don't know what the Islanders are going to do. I just want to know from your standpoint, would Casey Cizikas look good in a Penguin uniform?
Yeah, I mean, it would be hard to see, to imagine him leaving New York at this point. I think any team looking to improve their fourth line depth would welcome Casey Cizikas, and especially in the case of the Penguins, since, you know, if they do lose a forward, especially if it's someone like Bluger, to Seattle, and what you're gonna, Malkin probably won't be ready to start the season. That's what it's sounding like. So I mean, that would be nice, but it would just be hard to see him leaving New York.
Yeah, but now again, like a lot of teams, they have cap issues themselves. So I think it's gonna be an interesting offseason as far as what teams can do and what they can't do in regards to free agency. Another guy that kind of a friend of the show, let's go on the back end for a second. Any interest, Dave, in a guy like Ian Cole? You had talked about before the trade deadline, one of the things you thought the Penguins could add is it's just a little bit more of a grit back there. Certainly a good shot blocker, had a tremendous season 2 years ago in Colorado, and last year was part of the turnaround there. We had him on the show. He certainly didn't sound like he was for sure going back to Minnesota.
No, I mean, anything the Penguins do is going to be dictated by money.
Right.
I mean, they have very little cap space to work with as it is, and, you know, perhaps there will be a nice chunk of it opened up if they would lose, say, Jason Zucker to Seattle in the expansion draft. That might give them a little more flexibility to explore the market. But if they, you know, if they would lose Zucker or Bluger or any other forward, it means they wouldn't be losing Marcus Pettersson, which means that unless they would move him in a separate deal, they really don't have a pressing need on defense. So I'm not sure that prioritizing somebody like Ian Cole would be a prudent move on their part. Certainly, all things being equal, if they didn't have to worry about money and if there was an obvious space for him, yeah, I think he would be a nice guy to add to your defense, you know, in a nice blue-collar role.
Yeah. Taylor, him or a guy like David Savard, who just won a cup in Tampa, has played, had a really good run in with the Blue Jackets. Interest in either one of those guys to maybe help them. Fairly affordable, I would think. Both guys would be fairly affordable, depending on who ends up leaving, as the way Dave laid that out. Possibly if Pettersson gets moved, is that someone that makes sense to you?
Savard to replace Pettersson, I would say no, just because Savard is a righty. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they can't, I would say maybe if they can't bring back Cody Ceci, but I can't imagine that their cap hits would probably be about the same at this point. Ceci and Savard. So Savard, I would say no, but I mean, Cole could replace Pettersson if they do end up moving out Pettersson, because Ian Cole, he is left-handed and he does play the left side. He can also fill in on the right side too. He could be that kind of depth. But if we're talking about replacing Pettersson, if Pettersson goes out, I mean, Cole over Savard. I don't know. Ian Cole, he did tell some news on the show. He would, you know, ideally, he said he would love to go back to Minnesota, but, you know, they have a lot of cap issues now. They did just buy out. They just free up with the buyouts.
Right.
On Tuesday. So I don't know how that affects things. You know, if he would still be able to go to Minnesota, I don't know what the rest of their free agent plans look like. But I wouldn't rule Ian Cole going back to Minnesota. So.
Okay. Two other guys that going back to the forwards that I would have some interest in. We'll start with Joel Armia, who fans just got to watch Armia play with the Canadiens. They made the deep run, obviously, all the way to the Cup. And Nick Foligno, who was traded to Toronto. That didn't work out well. But when you're talking about maybe trying to add something to your forecheck, I think both of those guys are players that would possibly be in there. And also, you know, a guy like Blake Coleman, although I don't know if they would have the money to make that kind of move. Dave, any of those three appealing to you?
I mean, I like Armia. If they don't lose a center, you know, I'm not sure, you know, that bringing in a guy like him would be a priority.
Right.
Again, you know, they don't have the luxury of hoarding capable bodies. You know, they just don't have the cap space to do that. Foligno, I don't know what he has left. I'm not suggesting that he doesn't have enough left. I'm saying that I don't know,
right,
you know, whether he does enough to have a valid opinion about him.
I think he would be a short term. If you were going to sign Nick Foligno, I think that would be a very short term deal.
Blake Coleman, I think a lot of teams would like to add a guy like that, but I don't know how many are going to have the cap space that would be necessary to do it. He's not going to come cheap.
No, and winning two cups, Goodrow's also available. Yeah, but so both of those guys who came in a couple of years ago and won two cups with Toronto, with Tampa, are both free agents. You have to think that as Tampa starts to try to hold on to their core players, those are the type of guys that are going to shake loose and probably be elsewhere next season. That's why I thought we would bring them up. The group of forwards, the cluster of forwards we just talked about there, Taylor, any interest in any of those guys like Armia, Foligno, the like?
I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, if we're talking centers though, Nick Bonino, is also.
You saw that name, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, he's, because I've been looking, you know, Cap Friendly is, they have, if you look on their homepage, they do have a pretty good, you know, lists of the unrestricted free agents and then all their, you know, stats and what they made last year all in one place. But yeah, Nick Bonino stands out, I think, because he did play here. But then, I mean, if we're talking about potentially getting bottom six center depth, depending on who they lose to the Kraken, or just because, you know, Malkin might not be ready to start the season, and you might have, you know, Carter playing second line center. Just having that depth, I think, would help. And I think Bonino, he hasn't, he's not, you know, the same exact player that he was in here say before, but he's still, you know, useful.
That they've kind of been searching for that the Nick Bonino ever since he's left, haven't they? And I wonder if Nick Bonino, kind of in his heart, wonders, he certainly got paid, so you're never going to turn down money. But that was a marriage that really seemed to work well together. Dave, again, if you end up losing a center in the expansion draft in Teddy Bluger, would you kick the tires on Nick Bonino?
I mean, he's a guy I would consider. Again, you know, as a guy I haven't seen much of since he went to the Predators, I don't know that I'm ready to pass judgment on him today. But, you know, his certainly the, you know, the core of his game fits the role that you would envision him taking on if he were to return to the Penguins.
Yeah. Taylor, a name that you have mentioned several times on the podcast, especially right at the end of the season. Certainly goaltending has been a red hot issue after the way things ended last season with Tristan Jarry. Linus Omark is one of the guys who are free agent. Omark, who is big, who's often hurt, but is pretty good when he's in the lineup in front of a really crappy team. Any interest in there or the kid or the guy in Florida who's also available?
Yeah, Dreger, both of those are really the two big UFA goalie names on the market. You got guys who could still, you know, contribute, I think. But with both of them, there's the risk of, you know, Seattle taking either of them to be, you know, like a backup or 1A, 1B. But Allmark, yeah, I would lean towards, I mean, Jarry is going to be back. Jarry is going to be the guy. But if they can have a better guy behind Jarry to maybe share more of the load than the Smith did, and just to be there, he could push Jarry, but then also insure him. So if, you know, you do get to the playoffs and he does start to falter, you definitely have a backup that you'd be confident in if you could upgrade the backup, maybe more confident in than you would be with the Smith. So I would look at that, see what, you know, what kind of market it is for them if they are available and they don't go to Seattle.
I don't know that either of those guys has any more of a playoff pedigree than Casey DeSmith does.
Well, I was just going to ask you, would you do any of those guys interest you, or would you just stick with DeSmith in this conversation?
Yeah, I mean, if they are committed to sticking with Jarry, then, yeah, I mean, you know, they've got the Smith for another year on a decent contract. I don't know. You know, I have nothing against Allmark or Dreger, and, you know, perhaps they would thrive in a playoff environment. But that, you know, that's an unknown at this point. So I don't think you would bring either of them in, you know, confident that, you know, they would give you significantly more than Casey DeSmith could.
Yeah. Well, it's all going to start as we mentioned. It's been it just seems like a long summer already, and we're barely into the midpoint of July. But again, things are going to start heating up. Dave and Taylor are going to have a lot to start writing about here in the next week or so. As we know, the Stanley Cup was just awarded, and not long after it was awarded, to the Tampa Bay Lightning, and headed to Montreal, but not for the Canadians to party with, but for repairs to the Stanley Cup. The cup was dented. I mean, by now, I'm sure fans have seen the pictures of the cup. It was dented in celebration with the Lightning. And it's just the latest in the colorful saga of the Stanley Cup and the abuse that the Cup has taken over the years from people eating dogs or feeding their dog out of the Cup to bathing their kid in it. There's just no end to some of the indignities our fair Cup has suffered. And Dave, I know this is something that bothers you, and I'm not saying that I don't agree with you on this one. When you see something like this and see the damage to this thing that these guys kill themselves over to try to win, what goes through your mind?
Well, I mean, I honestly don't get it. This is, you know, a trophy that these guys claim to revere, to cherish, that they've made it their life's work to pursue, you know, and then they use it as a porta potty for their children. They smash it. They send it to the bottom of swimming pools. I honestly don't get it. And I am guessing I have a more extreme position than most on this. I've actually been fortunate enough to be near the trophy several times, but I won't touch it because that's something I figure should be reserved for the people who actually earn it. So as I say, I recognize that my view is probably beyond that of most people, but I really don't understand, you know, abusing it the way that teams do, including the Penguins.
Well, we're going to have Bob Arey on here shortly. We'll ask him as well about that, and has his views of the Cup changed over the years. Taylor, this is your thoughts on this. We had Nikita Kucherov last week, and in his post-game airing of grievances, and now we have more news out of Tampa with the Cup getting dented. Where do you fall in line here? Funny or enough of this? Enough treatment of poor Stanley?
I mean, the Cup, you know, taking abuse dates, that's the tradition that dates back longer than the league's been around. I mean, the earliest one that I know of is when an Ottawa player in 1905 punted it into a canal. I mean, it was smaller then. And I mean, and that was intentional. A lot of this stuff since then, either we don't know how it happened or it's definitely not intentional. I mean, it definitely needs repairs often. I mean, the Capitals, they had it dented in 2018. I mean, if you look back at it was either 16 or 17. There's a picture of Matt Cullen holding it in some kind of celebration, and it's dented at the bottom. So, I mean, the Penguins and, you know, the most recent one, I don't think they're doing it intentionally. It's 35 pounds. If it gets knocked over, if it falls over, it's going to, you know, get dented. Well, there are a couple of, like, in 2011, one of the Bruins had it. And there's video of it. It was like he was having a big, you know, media day, and they came out. There's a table set up for him, and he goes out and he puts it on the table, and the table collapses under the weight of it, and then it, you know, the bowl gets dented, kind of, and it fell on its side, so it looks like the way the Tampa one did. Now, you look at the video. I mean, that was definitely not, you know, reckless or anything he did on purpose. So, I mean, that happens. In 08, the Red Wings dented it. It fell off a table at a restaurant at the party. So there are definitely a lot of, like, unintentional ones. We don't know how the Lightning did it, but, I mean, there are far worse things that have happened to it. I mean, in the 60s, the Leafs dropped it a bonfire. The management from the 1940 Rangers burned the mortgage.
Yeah, and I think that one, karma took over and said, you want to do that? Here, wait 54 years till you win another one.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Messi, I think multiple times he was, like, personally responsible his days of the Cup with really damaging it. I know in the 80s he took it out to a strip club and left it, like, on the stage for, like, the dancers to, like, interact with. And it had a lot of damages by the end of the night. And he took it to an auto repair shop. I just saw the reaction on Twitter. It was funny. It's a lot of, like, it was, like, Montreal fans, like, you know, this would never happen in Montreal, but, like, there are several stories of, like, this happening when the Canadians had the Cup, or people saying, like, individual players. Like, the one I saw was, like, Steve Yzerman would never approve of this. I don't know why Steve Yzerman came to mind, but Steve Yzerman, when he had the Cup one time, he tied a rope around it and took it out on a jet ski. So it's like every anecdote of, like, all the, like, any of these pearl clutching takes, like, oh my God, this person or this team would never, it's like, you can probably find an anecdote of that happening. It's, I mean, all the post-cup celebrations get out of hand and all the work that goes into it.
I honestly believe there's a stunt cup. I believe there's a stunt cup. I've always had the Jackie Chan of trophies needs a stunt cup.
Well, there's three. There's the original bowl was getting too thin, so that's in the Hall of Fame. Like the one. Yeah, that's in the Hall of Fame. It's not attached to anything. But then if you go, like right now, if you go to the Hockey Hall of Fame, there's the cup there. That's the permanent one. There's that. And then the one that the players get and take around all summer, that's called the Presentation Cup. And there are some slight differences off the top of my head. I don't remember. But like there are some mistakes on the original engravings of the cup, or like names that shouldn't be there, like misspellings. And then on, I believe it's on the Hockey Hall of Fame Cup, the one that lives there permanently, those are corrected. And I think on the Presentation Cup, the ones that the players actually get. So what is the real cup? I don't know. There are two, and they do different things. But, I mean, it's been through a lot, and I think that's one of the cool things about it. You know, it's not like there's one that the players get, and it's been through all this. I think that's a cool part of its story. Like the Lombardi trophy, well, you get a new one every year. There's no like real history behind the trophy you're holding. But the cup, I think it's one of the cool things about the league.
My favorite trophy story is George Costanza dragging it around the back of his car in the Yankee parking lot, trying to get fired. But that's a story for another time. All right, when we come back, we will be joined by Bob Urey, and we will ask him about cup abuse as well. Stay with us on the 66 to 87 podcast. Welcome back to the 66 to 87 podcast. And as promised, the television analyst does a great job on television with Bob Urey is here. And also just as relevant in this conversation, a Stanley Cup winner in Pittsburgh, a two-time Stanley Cup winner in Pittsburgh. And the Cup is in the news again this week, and not just that Tampa Bay won it, but a trophy that takes all kinds of abuse through its history. Dented this week, as we mentioned in the last segment, going to Montreal for repairs. Bobby, you guys, kind of legendary what happened when you guys celebrated with the Cup. Can you, for listeners that may be a little bit younger that don't remember the 91 and 92 Cups, how did you guys celebrate with it?
Yeah, I guess it's how did we not celebrate with it, because everybody had a lot of fun. You know, once we got home and got a little bit settled after the initial celebration on the plane and with our significant others and everybody else on the team, it might have been a day or two later. We were over at Lemieux's place in his pool with the cup, and we certainly dented it there. It ended up on the bottom of the pool, and you know, we after that, everybody had their turn with the cup, and you didn't have, like nowadays, you have a guy that comes along and brings the cup to your place to make sure that it doesn't get stolen or something. I actually went to the old Hockey Hall of Fame with my buddy. And we picked the cup up, and it was in kind of a coffin like thing. We didn't even check. We were halfway home from Toronto to Peterborough at my cottage residence, and on the way we stopped at a Subway just to make sure that it was actually in the back. And we got it home, and you know, nobody was following us. We could have done whatever we wanted. We stopped at a couple of bars on the way home. We had a huge party. On the lake, and everybody took pictures there that we still look back at to this day. So we had a lot of fun with that cup.
When was that different? I mean, obviously you've been fortunate enough to still stay with the team. You've seen these guys party with it. I know Phil Pritchard, I think, is kind of the keeper of the cup. Do you remember when that kind of changed, where the cup had a chaperone?
Yeah, I think it was when Dallas won it, because I know my friend on the lake, Dave Reed, had the cup up there after Dallas won it in the late 90s, and he was up there with it then. So he had the white gloves. He was, you know, he was looking after that cup, and I think it changed probably, you know, in the mid 90s. You know, 95, 96 is probably when when they made the switch. Maybe we forced them to make the switch after we had too much fun with it back then. Maybe they really were worried that it was going to be misplaced.
Does what happened with the cup this week, does that, as a player, I mean, you guys had your fun with it. Do you worry that something goes sometimes a little too far with that, or it's the tradition of the cup?
No, I think, you know what, I was really excited to see the way they celebrated with that cup. I think that's the way you have to do it. That's what, you know, and especially to see other people not from other continents celebrate with the exuberance that we did here in North America. I mean, you know, we grew up, in North America wanting to win the Stanley Cup. I'm not sure, you know, guys like Kucherov, if they were trying to win Olympic golds or world championships, number one, or if they always thought about winning the Stanley Cup. So, you know, I guess they showed us this week that it was just as important to them, you know, regardless of where you're from, the Stanley Cup is the ultimate trophy in sport. And I'm glad they celebrated the way they did. And, you know, I know they have a couple, some carbon copies. That's probably not the original that they have all polished up in the Hockey Hall of Fame right now. So, you know, I know it got dented up a little bit. They'll get it fixed, but it won't be the first time.
All right, let's go a little bit back into your career. Hey, when you had Steve Yzerman as your center in Peterborough, did you realize at the time how good his career was going to turn out to be in the NHL?
Yeah, I don't know. You just never know. But, you know, I mean, I knew he was a cerebral hockey player. He was not one-dimensional. I knew that he was, you know, he was a Crosby-type player before Sidney Crosby. He was a guy that, you know, if you gave him a hard time, he'd give it back. He was a guy that would never cower. He was a guy that was tough as nails. He took a beating back in the day when we had to play the Oshawa Generals and in the playoffs. And, you know, I remember in the closing game against the Generals one year when we didn't move on, his half his lip was ripped off, to be quite honest with you, with a high stick. I mean, they went after him. It was brutal. But, you know, he never shied away from anything. Always a character type player and an ultimate competitor and one of the fiercest competitors I've ever seen play the game. A guy that had to rebuild his knee and really, it didn't matter. You couldn't stop him. He was a guy that, you know, that Sidney Crosby looks up to, that a lot of players like to emulate. And for me, one of the best two-way players ever to play the game. What a competitor. I don't know how his, didn't know how his career was going to end up. It looked for a while there that they were going to move him from the Detroit Red Wings, maybe back to Ottawa near his hometown, but it didn't happen. He stayed and the rest is history.
Skipping ahead to your time in Pittsburgh, just what was your initial reaction to being drafted by a franchise that was really struggling, you know, on and off the ice when you joined it in the 80s?
Well, my initial reaction was they're so bad that I got a chance to make this hockey team. That's what I thought. You know, I'm a 18, 19-year-old coming into a situation where I can get a chance to play because, you know, they need to fill some holes. You know, it turned out that it was a struggle right from the get-go from me. You know, after the first game, it was kind of downhill ever since. Hard to score goals. You know, I just didn't really have the attitude, the game, or the skills, you know, nor the mindset to really get it done. So it took a lot of trial and tribulation. Quite honestly, I didn't think it was going to work out for me. I was in Baltimore for a couple of years. They really had no plans for me. I got lucky when I was called up in about my third year when the team was going bad again. And my first shift, they put me with Lemieux and I scored two goals in 14 seconds. And that was it. And just, I was very fortunate. I was very lucky. You know, like I said, I grew a lot in the 10 years that I played in Pittsburgh. I wouldn't trade it for the world, but, you know, I don't know if I'd wish it upon anybody either. Those first 5 years, they were real, real hard, real brutal. And, I was looking to do something else.
Looking ahead to that 91 team, when did you realize that team was a serious contender to win the Stanley Cup?
I'm not so much from that. You know, I think that team had been starting to build itself around 88, 89, when we looked like we, you know, all through the trial and tribulation, we end up losing to Philadelphia. But, you know, in the playoffs, but it continued on and the team grew with its belief. And then all of a sudden, you know, we added some older players, some past champions. You know, we had become a resilient hockey team, a team that, you know, had Mario Lemieux on it, the best player in the game. So surrounded him with some players, realized we had to play defense, high scoring team that realized they finally had to play defense and get their noses dirty to get things done. Because, you know, sooner or later, you can't outscore anybody. And that team, well, I don't know what to say. I mean, yeah, we did win 8-0 in the final game against Minnesota, but there was a zero on the other end, wasn't there? So, you know, we proved that we could play defense too.
Do you have any favorite Jágr stories from that first year, his first year in North America?
I don't know. You know, I remember when he came in and Rick Keough was working with him, and he didn't look like he could even raise the puck, for crying out loud. You know, he could skate. He held the stick differently. He had the long hair. He just didn't, he was a different breed right from the start, but boy, did he prove everybody wrong. And he was, you know, he just had, you know, he wanted to do things his way, and he had a way about it. You know, he was pretty quiet the first year. He knew how to fit in with a group of elder statesmen, if you will. But, you know, he became quite a leader in his own way, and one of the best puck protectors and stick handlers I've ever seen in the game.
You touched on the additions the team made that year, you know, through Terry. Just how big were those, you know, those guys coming in? What kind of impact did they have, you know, right away?
Which one, sorry?
Just you mentioned the trades throughout the year. How big were those?
Well, they are. I mean, you know, you think you can win with the guys you got, and we did have good players, but you don't trade good players like, you know, Johnny Collins unless you know, you can't get good players back. And, boy, there's a lot of people weren't happy with that, including the players that were playing on his line, like the Reckies or the Kevin Stevens. But, you know, I guess it's not always about being comfortable. And sometimes you got to get out of your own skin. And sometimes maybe somebody's got to give you, a pat on the back. Or sometimes it's a little more than that. You know, sometimes it's a little whack to get you going. And you know, Craig Patrick wasn't afraid to make a move. Our team needed a little bit of a shakeup. I just think we just needed to be stronger defensively, harder to play against. And, you know, when you add guys like Samuelson or Francis, guys like that, you just, that's what you're getting right away. You're getting tougher to play against in both those players. You're getting some leadership. And, you know, you're saying you can give up maybe a power play goal here and there for a big penalty kill or somebody that can somebody that can bop somebody on the other team in the nose. And that's what we needed. I mean, we went against Minnesota at the end and they tried to absolutely everything they could. I mean, seriously, you know, short of going to jail, watch, you know, you look at some of those games now, you know, people are talking about the games this year in the playoffs. Take a look at the game, some of the final games that we played against Minnesota. That was brutal.
Yeah. Dave. Dave.
I got a quick question here on the trades. One of the trades that, you know, again, this was the kind of the anniversary of the cup winning trade, and everyone obviously focuses on the Francis and Samuelson trade, but since Taylor asked you about bringing Jágr in, how much did bringing Herdina in help with Jágr and just maybe the homesickness and help him? And Herdina ended up helping me. I think he scored a Game 7 goal. How much did that little trade help you guys?
Well, you know, those things are big. Yeah, those things are big. You know, Jágr was young, and you know, he was kind of freewheeling it both on the ice and off the ice. I think you need a little bit of a mentor there. I think Herdina was somebody you can talk to and somebody you can, you know, rely on him both off the ice and on the ice situations. I thought Herdina was fantastic. I thought he was a great hockey player. It wasn't just what he did, obviously, for Jágr, but it was really for the rest of the team. I mean, he always had a smile on his face, and what a hockey player he was. I mean, a great two-way hockey player. He could do a lot of things for us. Every time I see him, I it makes me feel good. You know, just the way he was with people, a people person. You know, he could have been a real good coach in the league. He was easy to talk to. He had an angle on everything. He was very worldly. I mean, I love people like that, and And that's what he brought. He brought all of those things and more.
Bobby, everybody remembers, or at least everybody who's old enough remembers 91 for you guys winning the cup. What I think tends to get overshadowed a bit is that a couple months before that, you guys won a division for the first time in franchise history. How big of a deal was that to you guys at the time that you finished first in the Patrick?
Yeah, I think all those little stepping stones, Dave, are very important. I know I mentioned earlier, you know, how 88, 89, how I thought that was a good turning point for the franchise. It just looked like we could compete. I think all those roadblocks that you knock down along the way, you know, the next step you get to, I think you need that. You see that with a lot of teams. A lot of teams I played on were like that. The Detroit Red Wings in the mid-90s, or even Tampa now. Even some of the Penguin teams, again, that have gone back-to-back just recently. You can't just go from the bottom to the top. There's got to be a kind of a progression along the way. And I thought that was another one, Dave, that was very important to win that Patrick division. I mean, those teams can I say they absolutely just killed us for years? I mean, win for 16 years in Philadelphia. I mean, that was brutal. Just winning a game there was a stepping stone. So everything you can do along the way, you break down those doors, and that's what that team was able to do.
Kind of in that vein, with the tough times you went through as a team through the first five or so years of your career, was there a guy you played with who wasn't around when you finally did win a cup, who you wished could have been there? You know, the guys who come to mind are guys like Johnny Cullen or Roddy Buskus, guys like that.
Yeah, that's a good point. Or Robbie Brown, because I love Brownie. I just think he's an unbelievable hockey player. He's another guy that I could fit into that category that I wish was around. You know, he's a guy that brought so much to our line in 88, 89. Just a great, really a cerebral hockey player that you wouldn't have known. He was able to come back and play with the Penguins in a different role. I listened to him on the Edmonton Oilers broadcast. I mean, he's unbelievable. One of the best. And his insight into the hockey game, his angles, the way he looks at things, he's unbelievably smart. I mean, look at the numbers he put up in junior. Guys like, I would have loved him to be a part of it. That's a great question. You know, I'd like to trying to think about some of the guys that I play with, Dave, that I would have liked to have been around. I mean, there had to be some. As soon as I get off the phone with you, they're going to come to mind. I know that. And but it's the guys that went through the tough times. You know, I mean, I'm so glad that guys like Troy and Phil were able to stick around through those tough times. You know, I know there's other guys. You mentioned Rod Buskus, who I still talk to this day, and met him in Vegas a couple of years ago. He's doing great in life, and him and his wife. So, you know, but those other guys, those guys who went through tough times before that. Can you imagine a guy like Danny Heron? I'd love to see him around for a Stanley Cup. I love playing. Love playing with him, like a Gilles Meloche. Those guys were incredible. Like Rick Keough, I would have loved to win a cup with him. I was with him in the early 80s. Some of the great guys in the game that you still bump into, and you remember the good ones in the game, and then the other ones, they kind of come and go in your memory. But you certainly remember some of the good ones, and those were some of the great ones.
Oh. Turning the page to the current team, Bobby, do you think this group can seriously contend for another cup? And if so, you know, what has to happen to make that possible?
Well, they have to. You know, you can't be playing at least three players in their mid-30s. It might be four this year, the amount of money you're going to be paying them. I mean, somewhere along the line, if these players are going to stay with the Penguins, they're going to have to take a reduction in salary. I know, that might be coming for one of them if they're going to stay a Penguin, but you can't pay three players, you know, upwards of $10 million a year, unless they're in their prime of their careers. And, it's pretty hard to have three players on the same team that would be in the prime of their careers in their mid-30s. That's just impossible. So let's talk reality and realize that there's going to have to be, you know, you look at all the teams that win, and it's a, you know, they win because they win with four lines. So you can't be top heavy anymore in the game and expect to win. And you have to be able to filter some of those dollars down into your third and fourth lines. And it's going to be hard to do unless somebody's willing to take a pay cut on this current roster. You know, you're just going to have to make changes, Dave. I've said that for, I've thought that for several years here now. I don't know what they're going to do here moving forward, but you know, that's why you're a general manager in this league, is to make the hard decisions. And, you know, I think Jim made them prior. I thought he did a tremendous job here. I don't know why he had to leave. You know, that'll come out somewhere down the line if it hasn't already. But I, you know, this new regime, they're going to want to put their stamp here on this hockey team, and they're going to make changes. There's no question about it. I don't know what they're going to be, and it could happen as soon as tomorrow, but there's going to be some changes made here. I don't know how drastic they're going to be, but I wouldn't be surprised, you know, if they make one of those blockbuster deals.
Yeah. Good stuff, Bob. We thank you so much for having you on. And that is it for this edition of the 66 to 87 podcast. For Bob Airy and for our panel, Taylor Haas and Dave Molinari, this is Tom Reed. We'll see you next time on the 66 to 87 podcast.